is WOBC 91.5, Oberlin College and Community Radio, and you're listening to The Weekly, a roundtable show devoted to discussing current news and events happening in Oberlin. Each week, we'll discuss topics uniquely relevant to the Oberlin community, drawing insights from student journalists, administrators, alumni, and community members to analyze what's happening here on campus. I'm your host, Sarah Dalgleish. You can also listen to current and past episodes of The Weekly in podcasts on iTunes and Google Play. Just search for The Weekly Oberlin. We're live this week, and the show is an open forum to discuss, debate, and analyze what's happening here in Lorain County. We value your feedback, so give us a call if you have an opinion or want us to cover a particular topic. You can reach us by phone at 440-775-8139 or email us your comments. It's a Meet Swing lecture by Catherine de Lazaro, PhD, class of 2000, a clinical associate professor of writing at Yeshiva University at 4:30 p.m. in King.
March 13th, Give Blood, Help Save Lives. All presenting donors will receive a gift card for one free attraction at Scene 75 Entertainment Center, Brunswick, and a $5 Chipotle gift card. To schedule an appointment, go to redcrossblood.org and enter sponsor code Wilder Hall Student Union.
You're listening to The Weekly, a production of WOBC 91.5 FM. I'm your host, Roman Brzkowski, and I'm joined by my co-host, Sarah Dalgleish. We're very pleased to be talking with one student senator, who is also a member of the Title IX Policy Committee, Kirsten Mozicek.
Hi, great to be here.
Now to our show. A content warning to our listeners, the following show will talk about sexual assault.
So Kirsten, thank you so much for being with us today. Could you describe your role as a member of the Title IX Policy Committee?
Yeah, definitely. So the biggest thing with the Title IX Policy Committee and my role on it, and Ravi as well, is just that we're student representatives. So we're both student senators, which is sort of convenient because it helps connect us to student government overall. But more than anything, we're just there to provide student input on the policy and the changes and just make sure that the committee has its ear to the ground when it comes to what students are feeling and what we think could be improved.
So other than students, who else is on the committee?
It's a huge mixture of people. So we've got the student members. Becky Mosley is the person who's the director of the committee. She's also the director of the Title IX office. And then there's a variety of faculty members and staff members. So there's people from like human resources that are there so they can give a staff perspective. And then there's a couple of different professors from like the theater and dance department and sort of all over the place. And then also a conservatory faculty member.
Okay, so in November, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos proposed new Title IX standards. A 2-month comment period began after the announcement and ended on February 28th. DeVos' proposal is now going through the process of becoming law. Though this could take up to a few years, many colleges are already talking about how the changes could affect their institutions. Could you talk a little bit about how these new changes will affect Oberlin?
Yeah, definitely. So I think I'll probably first go over just what some of the changes are potentially going to be. Some of them will affect Oberlin. Some of them are not going to affect us so much, but I'll just go over sort of like what all of them are planned out to be potentially.
Perfect.
So one of the first things is that there's a new, stricter definition of sexual harassment underneath these policy guidelines, which is definitely something different and departing from what it was previously under the Obama administration. Another big thing is that there's going to be geographic restrictions as to like how the policy can be enforced. So previously it was that like anyone involved in like student programming, or if you were involved in a student group, if you were studying abroad, anything that was connected to your college or university institution was under the purview of your Title IX office. But with these new restrictions, it would be like only things that are on your campus and like directly associated with like Oberlin programming would count. And that would be like something that you could talk about and like work with under the office's purview. So if you're abroad or you live off campus, or if you're like not participating in a college activity or program when something happens, then the Title IX office technically can't help you in that situation or hold someone responsible in that situation. Something else that could potentially be happening is that it The policy would only hold schools responsible when the leadership was directly aware of some sort of assault or misconduct. And this could potentially be a problem because it can really bog down the process in general. This might not be as big of a problem for Oberlin because Oberlin already trains all of the staff and faculty members really well on what Title IX processes are. And that's been like a huge thing that they've been trying to do in the past year is like rolling out a lot of training to make sure people are prepared. So that wouldn't necessarily be a problem here, but it could be at other schools. Another big thing is that there might be a higher standard of proof. So that's something that may or may not affect Oberlin. And then a really big thing is that they're moving towards a entirely live hearing and cross-examination process. And this is something that I think probably worries me the most about what the policy could be changing into, because there's already a hearing and panel process like at Oberlin and at a lot of different schools. But with this, you would have to allow for cross-examination by advisors. And advisors can be a lot of different people. As it currently works, it could be a professor that you know really well. It could be like someone from faculty member or staff, or it could be something like your boss or someone that you trust a lot. And in this case, advisors would have to be like they could be absolutely anybody, which could include lawyers or parents, attorneys, etc. And that like, puts up a really big imbalance of power. And with this live hearing and cross-examination process, those advisors would be able to directly question the people involved, the responding and the reporting party, and there wouldn't be able to be any intervention. So I can just see that. I can imagine it being really awful where there's someone who is like trained in the law and they're a parent and they're asking really invasive, pointed questions that are potentially really inappropriate. And the way that it currently stands at Oberlin is that we do have a hearing panel, but we allow the hearing panel to hear the questions that are going to be asked first, and then they're the ones who ask them. So that way they have an opportunity to rephrase things and sort of take away any of the judgments that initially might be put into the wording of the question. So that allows for people to get their questions answered and have that process, but it's not necessarily as traumatic for people. So I'm definitely a little bit worried about what that could end up being if that actually goes through. And one of the last things that I've been thinking about, and a lot of people have been thinking about with the changes, is that the policy proposes to make it more difficult for students to know if their school has requested exemption from some of these policies for religious reasons. And that isn't necessarily something that would affect Oberlin because A, we're not a religious institution, and B, we're a private institution. But that could potentially affect people at other schools, especially if you are part of the LGBTQ community and your school is requesting exemption from any of the policies that could normally protect you under the law. That could be potentially pretty scary.
So what is the justification behind these proposals, and why are such controversial proposals being put into law right now?
Yeah, definitely. That's a good question. I think a lot of people are thinking about that, about like, why did this even happen? I know some of the things that Betsy DeVos has been talking about is that she wants to make the process more fair and equitable for all parties involved. So the way that that's sort of been departing from how it was previously thought, at least under the Obama administration, is that like everyone has the right to be presumed innocent no matter what happens. But as I think we all know, in the reality is that that can make that a lot more difficult for people who are reporting, people who have experienced a lot of harm and are survivors and are trying to get justice through the process. It can be way, way harder for them to get that justice and get what they're looking for in the process.
Definitely. So in the press release that the Department of Education put out, Secretary DeVos is quoted saying, throughout this process, the process of changing the rule, my focus was, and always will be, on ensuring that every student can learn in a safe and nurturing environment. That starts with having clear policies and fair processes that every student can rely on. Every survivor of sexual assault must be taken seriously, and every student accused of sexual misconduct must know that guilt is not predetermined. We can and must condemn sexual violence and punish those who perpetrate it while ensuring a fair grievance process. Those are not mutually exclusive ideas. They are the very essence of how Americans understand justice to function, end quote. Do you, like, as someone who's very familiar with Title IX or, like, has worked with Title IX, do you think that the Department of Education's new proposal or new guideline meet that idea, meet those goals set out by the secretary?
Yeah. I would say I don't feel like the way that the policies are set up are actually going to do any of the things that Betsy DeVos is talking about. Like, I understand the sentiment that she's getting at, and I don't see that as necessarily invalid. Like, it would be great to have a process where we feel like everyone can get what they need out of it and that you're able to go through it justly and fairly, but I don't think that is a reality that we're living in. It wasn't a reality before, and it's definitely not going to be a reality after if these policies go through as are. I think a lot of the details of the policy more or less are just going to make it more and more difficult for survivors to be able to bring anything to a Title IX office, or even if they do, with the way that things are getting sort of tangled up with how where leadership responsibility comes in, could be really difficult. So even if someone does try to report something, if they don't happen to report it to the right person, that could completely stop the process. And that is something that's really scary. Yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about this, but could you elaborate on how these new changes or proposed changes compare to Oberlin's current process and how Title IX works currently at Oberlin?
Yeah, definitely. So the current main model that we have going on here is a hybrid model. So that means that we have a hearing panel of staff and faculty members, but we also have an outside investigator. And outside investigators have been something that a lot of institutions are using increasingly, and it's sort of being seen as like the gold standard now in higher education when it comes to Title IX proceedings. So that's actually something that was a part of the policy committee's work previously, is that we were thinking about moving to investigator-only model, but unfortunately, if these policies pass, then that wouldn't be something that we would be able to do. Currently, we have the outside investigator, and we have the hearing panel, and that's going to be staff and faculty that wouldn't know the students, which can sometimes be a little bit difficult because it is a small institution, which means sometimes it's just like a lot of librarians who may or may not be well-versed in the policy, and it's different people every time, and it's sort of been a difficult process, and that's something that we're hoping maybe to change, but I don't know how it's going to pan out post-policy implementation. The current jurisdiction for Oberlin's Title IX policy is like anything that happens to involve Oberlin students. So if that happens like in the town, if it's something just like at the FEV and an Oberlin student was either a perpetrator of harm or someone who had experienced harm, then Oberlin's Title IX office could step in some capacity, which is something that I'm really happy about that we can do now, and I'm definitely concerned about for the future. And we do currently have a lower standard of evidence when it comes to the process. So we're more at that like 50-50% idea, and then if these changes went through, we might have to increase that to more of like a 75% idea.
Yeah. So for a lot of people who've never really experienced anything with Title IX or like aren't familiar with the process, and myself included, I think we have a fairly strong misconception of what it is. Like, it feels very legalistic, like much like a trial. Mm. But then to talk to people who are aware of it like, it's not, right? It's not what it's supposed to be at all.
No, yeah.
But then this proposed rules like used a lot of legal language, and was like, can you, just so people who aren't aware, can you like elucidate like what is the difference between a trial and like Title IX programs?
Yeah, definitely. I can do my best on that. I think always Becky Mosley, who's the director of Title IX, does the best job of talking about it, but she has explained it to me before. So I can elucidate it a little bit, is that the process here is really supposed to be an educational process more than anything, and it's really what the college is trying to do to hold people responsible if they've caused harm to others, or be able to find justice for survivors within the system who need support in some capacity, if they need like interim measures about making sure that they don't have to see someone in their classes, if they need to be moved, anything like that. Like, Oberlin is just trying to help students in that capacity and hold people responsible for their actions. And in that way, it's very similar to the way that like other policies work at Oberlin. Like, you can't have candles in your dorm room. Like, technically the process is supposed to be vaguely similar to that. It's just definitely at a much higher stakes. So it makes sense for people to view it differently, and it should be viewed differently in that way, but it isn't a trial. And that's something that can kind of get lost, especially when you're reading these policies and you're trying to understand it. It feels like you're being put on trial for, you know, whatever has happened. And it definitely needs to be more of a conversation of like, harm has happened in some capacity, and we need to figure out what's going on so that both people can move forward and either be held responsible or find some way to be able to be supported.
So how has the Oberlin administration and Title IX office reacted to these changes?
the office is definitely not happy about it. I know, like, right after the proposal first came out, we had a meeting of the Title IX Policy Committee, and we just all sort of sat down, and Becky mostly handed out a piece of paper that listed out some of the main concerns that she had, and she was like, you know, we have to talk about this because this is going to affect us, and I'm not happy, and I'm not excited, but we need to take action and we need to be prepared, and I just want all of you to know right away what's going on and what the context is at Oberlin's campus specifically, so that we can move forward, especially because we were already in the middle of this policy rehaul, so having this come out right in the middle of that was a huge part of our conversation of like, okay, what do we have to scrap, what can we move forward with, and what are we going to do in the future. A big thing that Becky Mosley did, and also Ravi and I were involved with, was during this notice and comment period that you had mentioned earlier, is that Becky Mosley, along with a couple of other Title IX directors from various institutions in the Ohio area, signed a letter and like a general comment for the notice and comment about, you know, expressing their feelings, how they felt about it, what they were really concerned about, what they thought should change, how they thought it should be changed, with, you know, evidence as well as personal experiences as directors of Title IX. And they signed that, everyone co-signed it and sent that out. So that was put into the notice and comment. And then Ravi and I both spent a lot of time over winter term creating a document that had...
Ravi Astar, your co-senator.
Yes, okay. Yes. Sorry, I'm just name dropping. Ravi, who's on the committee with me, we spent a lot of time over winter term working on some notice and comment guidelines that just sort of outlined what those were, how you could submit them, what are the things that people are concerned about, what are we concerned about, what is the committee concerned about, and then giving people sort of language to be able to conceptualize it, so that if they wanted to write one, if they had the time and energy to be able to do that. So that's definitely been on everybody's radar, and it's just been a big conversation of like, what do we have to wait with and what can we move forward with right now in terms of policy?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of feels like we don't really hear about the Title IX office until something goes horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah.
But, like, from someone who's actually been working with it, like, how has the Title IX office been doing at Oberlin, like, since you were first year over the last 4 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's heavy. But, yeah, something that Becky Mosley once said to me that I really had never thought about before is exactly what you just said, that you never really hear about Title IX at schools until something isn't going right. And she was saying that largely, you know, some of the reason for that is that it is a really private process and it's really personal and it's hard and it's traumatic. And it's not something that people are going to talk about unless they need justice within it. Like, if something didn't go wrong, that is really the only time that someone is willing to put that much of a personal and horrible part of their lives on display for everybody else, which is why you don't always think about it as things going right, when a lot of times things are going well, but it's just like nobody wants to talk about that necessarily. But I also would say that there's definitely times where things haven't gone right, and the Title IX office didn't respond maybe the way that it should have, or information wasn't clear. So I've seen Title IX go through some changes, definitely in terms of clarity. I think that over the time that I've been here, they've been working a lot on trying to make the policy as clear as possible. That's a huge thing that we can do right now with the policy of the committee, is be able to make the language less full of legalese in general and just make it more understandable and provide like as many visuals as possible with like flowcharts. You've seen those around before, like just making them as available as possible to folks, so that if anything does happen, everyone here knows exactly how you can move forward and who you can go to.
Yeah, I think one of the other big changes that's been proposed is the change of the definition of sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
Under the Obama administration, it was unwelcome conduct of asexual nature, which I think that most people like intuitively see as what sexual harassment is.
Yeah.
But the Trump administration has proposed that it be changed to unwelcome conduct on the basis of sex that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it effectively denies a person equal access to the recipient's education, program, or activity. And I think what's ironic about this is just that, like, objectively offensive is a subjective term.
Yeah.
Do you have any feelings about this new description? Like, what does this mean for students?
Yeah, definitely. even just hearing you read that out loud, I have such like a visceral reaction of like, this is so, there's so many qualifiers leading up to the term of just like, yes, like sexual harm has been committed, but that there needs to be like so many qualifiers beforehand before you can consider it real is just like absolutely obscene to me and ridiculous, and not how any Title IX office should operate. And I don't think that that's going to be the way Oberlin's Title IX office operates. I think we do have some leeway when it comes to things like this. And I think in the sense that like we can move more broadly if we need to, and like we're always going to be trying to help students in any way. Yeah. And I think a big thing that Becky Mosley is excited about in general is that although like some of the policy changes might encourage students to seek other like informal processes through the Title IX office, and that might give Oberlin a little bit more leeway when it comes to exploring a restorative justice model, which is something that I think could be really good. So there is some potential good that could come out of this. Overall, I'm like not really happy about the policy and especially about the changes, but I think that Oberlin is resilient and that we're going to do whatever we can to make this work the best for students.
So I feel like Oberlin's Title IX office, as you mentioned earlier, does have a strong presence on campus as far as making students aware of what constitutes consent, what constitutes sexual harassment, and there are lots of campaigns that are very visible around campus showing that. But I know that one of the things that Betsy DeVos is arguing with this, these new proposed changes is that it sort of gives the college an out and gives the college less responsibility in cases of sexual harassment or sexual assault on campus. So do you think that there's a chance that there will be outside pressure from other parts of the Oberlin Institution on the Title IX office to adhere more strictly to these new laws if they're approved, and to sort of take less responsibility in these cases?
No, I don't think that that's going to be something that happens within our institution. I think that's something that Becky Mosley has been really clear about, which, I mean, is definitely really relieving to me. And I think to a lot of people, and especially the administration, is that, like, no matter what, we want to help students, and we're not going to make this more difficult for them. And in that way, I'm feeling a little bit more relaxed when it comes to some parts of the policy, because I know that Oberlin's Title IX office already does a lot of education and is recently especially trying really hard to make sure that like every staff, faculty, like administrator knows the Title IX policy inside and out, so that if any student came to them with any problem vaguely related to Title IX, that they would know how to get them through the system and who to bring them to, who to bring them to if they didn't want to report, who to bring them to if they did want to report, and make sure that they were going to be okay and had the support that they needed. That is one thing that I think Oberlin is committed to, and I don't think would be a problem if this policy moves forward.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think, Sarah?
Well, is this conversation, obviously, it seems like it is moving outside the Title IX office, and how are other faculty members, other people in administration responding to these changes?
I think the school in general is definitely sort of defaulting to the Title IX office, and specifically to the policy committee when it comes to like how this institution is going to respond to this if the policy goes into effect, and like what we're going to do moving forward. But we've been in conversation, I think, pretty much the whole time with faculty and with administration. Becky Mosley recently came to the General Faculty Council or to the General Faculty Committee to talk to everyone and give an update on what these proposed changes were from the Department of Education, and then how that might affect Oberlin, and then what we as a policy committee are going to be doing moving forward. And there's going to be a couple of forums coming up. I know that there's going to be a lot more conversations with general faculty and with the conservatory faculty, with the administration in general, and with students a lot as well, to make sure that everyone is on the same page and can get input so that we can sort of craft the best response and policy as possible if and when this all goes to effect, because the big part of it is that like it is a question mark right now, because they had an obscene amount of notice and comment time. Like, they had so many people make comments about what was happening within the policy, and I think that they're going to have to take the time to address all of those. I'm hoping some things are going to be changed and we might not have to worry about them necessarily, but that's also sort of an optimistic viewpoint, so I don't really know what's going to happen, and it's going to take a while for them to, you know, publish what they want to do, and then there will also be a period of time in which they allow institutions to have time to adapt their policies so that they can be in compliance, and that's going to take like another year or two, I feel like. So it's definitely something I'm not really sure how it's going to go down, because I'm graduating soon and I'm sort of watching this all happen in the future.
So is there any sort of strict timeline on this, or is it kind of a, like you said, like a big question mark, and we don't really know when it's going to come out, but it will sometime in the future?
Yeah, I don't think there's a hard timeline, but I vaguely remember hearing that it was going to maybe come out more towards the spring beginning, like end of spring, beginning of summer, potentially, if that was going to happen this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that while a lot of people are pretty worried about these new changes, people also had concerns about the previous system, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on the current, quote-unquote, current system? Like, is it effective? Does it provide justice for all parties involved? Like, are these new guidelines reacting to something that's there?
That's a good question. I think that our policy definitely has room for improvement, which is why we have these policy committees crop up so often. Like every couple of years, there's supposed to be a policy committee that exists so that there can be a long and hard conversation about like what has been working, what hasn't been working, what can we do to make it better, which I'm really glad that that happens so often. It's helpful for sure to keep an ear on the ground about like whether or not this is going well. I think students definitely have had troubles with the Title IX office in the past, especially when it comes to communication. I think that they're a small office and they deal with a lot, and that can be difficult. And I think that that is a huge part of what the proposed changes of our own policy were going to be in the first place before the Department of Education published this, is that we're just moving to make language more clear in general so that, and to make it a shorter policy. Like right now it's so many pages, like reading through it is just a nightmare, and there's parts that are repetitive and there's parts that are confusing and it just doesn't make sense. And having a policy that people can read clearly and concisely in a moment of like severe need is so, so integral and important into making a system that works. So I'm hopeful that that's going to happen even within this year and like maybe go into effect in the next semester, is that even if our policy at its core might change a bit because of like what happens with the Department of Education, more than anything, like people will be able to be at least clear on like what's going to happen.
So Oberlin has kind of a unique student body makeup in the fact that we have a much higher population of queer LGBTQ students and trans and non-binary students in comparison to other institutions around the country. Are there particular changes involved in these proposed laws that would potentially harm or concern Oberlin because of those demographics more than other schools?
I don't necessarily think that that's going to be a huge problem for Oberlin necessarily. I think that Oberlin is always trying to do better when it comes to serving our queer population on campus. Like that's like a huge part of I think what we stand for, and I certainly don't think that it's perfect, and I think there's a lot that can be done better, but I don't think that these policy changes would affect us necessarily. What I am concerned about is, as I mentioned before, is the religious exemption piece. This policy just makes it more difficult for students to find out if their institution has an exemption for religious reasons. And if you're exempting for religious reasons, a lot of time that can translate into things that are really harmful for LGBTQ students. So that is something I'm concerned about at larger institutions that are have any sort of religious affiliation. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm also thinking just since you and I have been here at Oberlin for the last 4 years, like there have been a number of stories where campus sexual assault, not just at Oberlin, but across the country, have like really burst into the I'm thinking of like the Brock Turner case where someone did something horrible and like didn't get, you know, fairly punished, I guess.
Yeah.
And someone just was denied justice. And how people have been protesting that. So there's definitely a movement to make it so that victims of sexual violence get more justice.
Mm-hmm.
Is there the opposite movement also? Like, is there like people who are advocating for this policy in the first place? Like, where did this policy come from?
Yeah, that is a good question. I don't entirely know the answer to that, but I do vaguely remember that there has been some conversations at like larger universities and from the families of people who have been accused of sexual assault and found responsible or not found responsible. Either way, like going through the process in some capacity, they feel like they've been harmed by the process, and that parents and family and friends have been really vocal about saying like, you have ruined someone's life by putting them through this process, which I, you know, is a conversation to be had, certainly. But I think the problem is that there's a disproportionate amount of people who have been victims and survivors of sexual assault or sexual harm in general that haven't been able to get that justice and have tried to go through the process and not had it, you know, get any sort of result that they were looking for. And that is a much larger problem. But I do think that there are people like in our country who are definitely thinking more about the people who are responding to the accusations.
So I think that this policy is coming at a really interesting moment in our country with the Me Too movement and with the Kavanaugh trial and all of that. And obviously Title IX is a great resource and it does great things, but it's a fix for a problem that has a lot deeper roots. So how do you think that Oberlin and other institutions in the U.S., especially if we're going to have to deal with these stricter guidelines for sexual assault on campus, how do we get at the root of that problem, and how do we work as an institution to stop sexual harassment instead of dealing with it through Title IX?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a big part of it is going to be the institution responding and like Title IX taking on as much of that education piece as they possibly can. But I think an even bigger piece is going to be a lot of peer education. Something great that I think most people know about that exists on this campus is PRISM. It's something that is operated through the Title IX office, but was originally started by a couple of students. And it's something that provides education for all of our Oberlin College students. Like everybody has to go to these PRISM workshops and they have really frank conversations about like what consent looks like, the way that substances can be involved, like how, you know, how the Title IX office works and like who you can go to, who you can get support from. And that's been, I think, really meaningful and like helpful on this campus in general. Just any increasing peer support in general is definitely something that I think is going to help. And peer support also in the sense of like, when you're in that moment of crisis, you don't necessarily want to go to an administrator. Like, you don't really want to talk to a faculty member. Like, you want to talk to a friend most of the time. And having people who are trained to be able to handle that and know who, you know, resources to give them and, like, what to do in that moment, having crisis responders in general is always really helpful. And navigating the whole mandatory reporter thing is, like, a big conversation that still needs to be had. That's something that, like, we still don't really have on this campus. Like, everyone pretty much who does support work, unless you're associated with religious life, or we have one person who, Melissa Counts, who is from the Nord Center, and she comes and has a couple of office hours in Peters over the week. Like, she's a non-mandatory reporter, and religious life associated folks are non-mandatory reporters. But other than that, like, pretty much everyone else would technically have to report if someone talked to them about experiencing harm in that way. And that can be a difficult thing to navigate. Like, people don't always feel supported in that way.
Yeah, to all our listeners, I just want to quickly apologize for the loud noise coming from the background. It is the radiator. Kirsten, I have a question. I've been seeing all these stickers and Facebook posts about this group on campus called OBI, I believe it's called. What is this, and what does this have to do with Title IX?
A well-placed question. Thank you, Roman, for asking. OBI stands for Oberlin Bystander Intervention, and it is a group that I co-started with my friend Deborah Johnson, who's an OC alum, 2018. And we were both on Student Senate. It was her sophomore year and my freshman year. And I had recently gone to a student government conference that had a couple of different interest rooms about like general issues on campus. And one of them was survivor support and Title IX on campus. And I was like, oh, I definitely want to go into that room. And we had a conversation with a couple of different students about programs that they had there at their school. And it was a peer support system that was non-mandatory reporters, which I thought was amazing. And I was like, we absolutely have to have that here. And I tried to bring it And I ran into some legal trouble because having a non-mandatory reporter who's a student is definitely a risk that, you know, is really difficult to take legally. And that's still a conversation that needs to be had. But I wanted to do something in the meantime. And Debs and I had been having a lot of conversations about how people had talked to us about not always feeling safe on campus when it came to parties, when they were at the SCO for Splitchers, like at Queer Beers, anything like that, Celerity, drag ball, like they didn't necessarily feel like someone was watching out for them. And that was something we wanted to change. So we created OBI and we trained students to be active bystanders in party situations. And we recently have been sort of sponsored by Eddie Gazemba, who is the health promotion director at Oberlin. So we're part of the Center for Student Academic Success. And we now are also taking on the role of like substance use safety and that sort of education. So it's active bystanding in a lot of different ways, but it's focused on like the party scene and how can you intervene safely if you see that somebody's not doing well for any number of reasons, or if you think a situation that you see somebody in is potentially unsafe.
And the program recently expanded, didn't it? In terms of like PRISM trainings, there are also now trainings involving bystanding, or like, could you talk a little bit more about that, or at least clearer than I can?
Yeah, I can try to elucidate things a little bit. So PRISM now has, they have their intro like consent class that all the incoming first years have to take. It's not during orientation, but it's like somewhere within the month after. And then second semester, they have another mandatory training, which has a more frank conversation about active bystanding and support in general. I don't know as much about the second workshop because it came into effect after we were first years, so I never got to go to it, but it sounds pretty awesome. And something that OBI has expanded into is we're hoping, and I think we're going to be at orientation now as part of mandatory substance safety training. So like when I was a freshman, I had to take like an online course about drugs and alcohol, and it was honestly just really unhelpful and like very shameful. So now we're hopefully going to do a peer education version of that with a lot of conversations about active bystanding and keeping people safe. And that's something I'm really excited about.
Could you elaborate a little bit on some of the other peer resources that are available to Oberlin students, such as the SIC and Peer Support Center?
Yeah, definitely. So there's quite a few different student organizations that are focused on peer support in general, which is something amazing about Oberlin that I absolutely adore. So we have PRISM, which is a little more formal, and it's associated with the Title IX office. They talk a lot about consent, active bystanding, and all of that. Then there's OBI, and now we're not as much of a student organization because we're like officially associated with an office. We focus on substance use training as well as active bystanding and providing active bystanders for some of the campus events. And then there's SIC, which provides a variety of different services. They help with free rides to Planned Parenthood. They can give you all kinds of different safer sex supplies. I think they can help with some general counseling and helping with, I know they sponsor like a lot of different events. They have Safer Sex Week, which is a week full of different workshops and events, and speakers will come to talk about anything generally related to safer sex and conversations about healthy relationships, which is absolutely amazing. I think they're recently are supporting a abortion doula workshop, which is really awesome, as well as a potential training for people who want to learn how to use Narcan, which is an opioid overdose reversal drug. That's absolutely amazing. What else do we have? So many different orgs.
In terms of Title IX, you know, what do you wish that more students knew about it? Either the office or the actual piece of legislation.
Yeah, I think more than anything, I want people to know right now that we are going through a policy rewrite, and that there's a committee for that, and that there are students on that, and that I am one of them, and that there are other students on it, and that it's a place that you can bring your thoughts and concerns. I hosted a listening session last year a little bit about like some of the proposed changes and things that we were thinking about. But that conversation is ongoing. And like, if you ever have anything you want to say about the Title IX policy, about the way the office works, that like, I am open to that. Becky Mosley is open to that. Like, you can talk to a lot of different people, and that there are opportunities to help change things, because like as much as I am always trying to get student feedback, like I don't know everything. So it's always really helpful when people tell me how they're feeling and like what is going on, because then I'm able to more accurately advocate for students when I'm in the room and like having those really frank conversations.
So you talked earlier about how the Title IX office was in the middle of an overhaul when this announcement came out. And are you still moving forward with those changes? And if so, will any of them be able to still be in place under DeVos's new laws?
Yeah, that's a good question. Some of them we're not going to be able to do if these go into effect. One of the big changes that I think I mentioned earlier a little bit is that we're thinking of moving towards an investigator-only model, where we have an outside investigator that is trained in Title IX proceedings, but doesn't, that like works for the college, but isn't a part of the college as like a faculty or administrator or anybody like that. And that's sort of become a big standard across a lot of universities. So a lot of places are either have already moved to that model or are moving to that model. And we were considering it, but I don't think that that's going to be able to happen if these policies go through the way that they are currently. A big thing that we will be able to do that I'm very excited about, as I said before, is just making the language as clear as possible and making the policy itself a lot shorter. It's really easy to get like parallel lines of information cropping up in that policy, and it just gets confusing really quickly. And there is a lot of legalese, and more than anything, we want to address the fact that like this isn't a legal proceeding, like it's not a trial, and people need to feel comfortable and feel like they have the power to advocate for themselves within the process, and we want people to know that and know that that's possible.
I mean, I'm not familiar at all with the investigator only model, and I know that that's actually coming under like direct attack by by this rule change. What are people's concerns with the investigator-only model? Like, why is that even an issue that we're seeing the administration deal with?
Yeah, so it was moving. I can talk a bit first about like why we moved towards the investigator model, and then why that's sort of coming under attack in general. Which is, you know, very valid. Like, there's a lot of pros and cons to any model. Like, addressing sexual harm on a campus is a really difficult thing to do, and no matter how you approach it, there's always going to be things that you could be doing better, and you just sort of have to weigh the options and see how you're going to be able to move forward best. But previously, with our hybrid model, with the panel, as I was saying before a bit, that it can't be anybody who knows the students personally. And because Oberlin is a pretty small institution, that can get really difficult to, like, you've absolutely never had a class with this professor, or you've never worked with this staff member before. So a lot of times it'll be librarians or students who, or like faculty members or staff members who aren't really as familiar with students, and they're pulling from a small pool that rotates constantly, and that can be really difficult because you get people who are on the panel who don't necessarily know the policy super well, or they do know the policy well, but they are rarely called upon to be a part of this hearing committee, and therefore they are like working and operating under things that they've read a million times, but that they've never really been able to do before, and that can be like a terrifying experience. Whereas the investigator, who's an outside investigator, is like well-versed in this. This is their job, and that means that they are able to navigate the system really well. They know what questions to ask. They know how to address things in like a very trauma-informed and sensitive manner, which is something that's so important when going through these proceedings. And a big problem with the hybrid model in general that we were looking to move away from was that it meant that people had to go through the process twice, because you had to do essentially the same thing with an outside investigator and also with the panel, which is just like bringing up more trauma, and it prolongs the process a ton because it's really hard to get a lot of people to be able to meet in the same room at one time at Oberlin. Like, that's impossible with like student organizations, let alone something as high stakes as this. And to be able to get it to happen twice in a quick manner can be really difficult. So it drags the process out. It's just like rehashing all of these horrible things that have happened again and again. And it oftentimes, you know, I know that Becky was saying that it was feedback coming from students who had been through the process that they said, like, do you really have to do this twice? Like, can't we move to just one or the other? So that was a big reason as to like why we were thinking about moving towards the investigator only model. And then a big reason that people are worried about the investigator only model is that it's one person. And that's like, that is kind of scary. Like, you're putting a lot of power into one person's hand. And they're really experienced and they're vetted thoroughly through the college to be able to get this position, and which is why they work with us. But it's definitely something that like students have been concerned about in the past when they heard that this was a possibility. And I can imagine that more broadly speaking, people would be potentially worried about that, especially if they think that there could be any sort of bias in one way or another.
If you're just tuning in, this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. So Kirsten, you talked a lot about all of these amazing student resources, peer organizations that we have on campus. Is there anything in DeVos's proposed changes that would prevent those or limit those in any way?
I don't think that that would be a problem necessarily, as far as I can think of with the policies, because it's more directed at the institution and at the office itself. I don't think that that would limit what students can do. And if anything, I think it'll motivate students to do more. And a lot of the organizing that isn't necessarily institution level, it'll be a great option to help with things. Because if you can't go through things the way you would want to at the office level, at least you have student organizations who can sort of take things on in some way.
So we're coming to the close of our show, but I want to spend time talking about something you've brought up a lot, which is these new changes that the Title IX office at Oberlin is pursuing, regardless of the federal changes. Can you explain a little bit, like, why has the office been pursuing changes? What sort of changes are you pursuing outside of the federal changes? And what were you hoping for?
Yeah. So the reason that we have been looking for a policy change and the reason that the committee exists in itself is that Oberlin's Title IX office has within its organizational structure, like they require themselves to do a policy overhaul and a policy review every couple of years. So I think the last time it was done was maybe in 2015, which is not that long ago. And it's something, this process started actually, last year. So it was still 2017, I believe, when this committee got together, when I like first got the email saying like, hey, we want you to do this. And a big part of that is just, it allows for like a systematic way to incorporate feedback into the policy every couple of years. That way that going through the processes and like hearing from students, hearing from faculty, hearing from people that are involved in it, there is a clear way for us to be able to incorporate that into a new policy and to make the policy better in some way or another, to figure out what works, what doesn't work, all of that. I think in regards to like what we're hoping for to get out of the policy changes in general, I think more than anything, it's just like clarity and conciseness, both in the language and in the process itself, is just to be as clear as possible and make sure that people feel like they're supported within it, and make sure that they understand what's going on the whole time. I think it can be really scary and horrifying, and it's super easy to misinformation when you're in a place like that. So to make sure that the policy and the process is as smooth and as supportive as possible is really important. And making it better in any way, that was the whole idea with moving towards the investigator-only model, was potentially we could make this a better process for students themselves going through it, and that's really important to the office in general. We also had some conversations about we were thinking about bringing in the policy that allows students to, medical amnesty. God, I couldn't think of that word. bringing in medical amnesty into the policy in some way as well, because a lot of times people would be afraid to report things that had happened because they were maybe under the influence when things were going on and they wanted to get justice and they wanted help because they had, you know, endured some sort of harm and they felt like they couldn't because they were afraid they were going to get in trouble for like underage drinking or something like that. So this, the policy changes that I think we're hoping to still put through and were definitely a part of our policy last year in like the proposed changes, was making it more clear that medical amnesty applies to everybody involved, and that way people could participate fully in the process and be able then to like not be worried about that and get tied up in that, and then not allow them to be able to talk freely about what had happened, with the caveat of course that if you were involved in that and you used substances to intentionally harm someone and to put them in a compromising position, then that medical amnesty doesn't count for that. Like, you will get the full like wrath of the institution if that was something that you did to another person.
So, Kirsten, we're starting to come to the end of our hour with you, but you're obviously someone who's been instrumental and very involved in all of these changes, both within the Title IX office and within peer organizations that you've started, that you've helped run. So I was wondering if you've seen a substantial change in the attitude of Oberlin students, Oberlin administration towards sexual assault in the 4 years that you've been here.
I think a big thing that I've seen students and administrators focusing on is definitely the peer support aspect. I think that's something that has been valued a lot more in the past, like in these recent years, like moving forward, especially since like PRISM isn't really that old. It's only like a couple years older than when I started here as a freshman. And now OBI exists and like the SAC is doing amazing things and OSCA has its shills and like there's a lot of opportunities for student support on campus. I think that's something that I've seen get stronger and stronger, especially with the national climate, the way that we think about how sexual assault happens on campuses and the way that it's institutionalized in a lot of ways, especially with the Me Too movement, more largely. I think people have been focused on what can we do in our communities immediately to make people ensure that they feel safe and ensure that they feel heard and that they're supported. And I think that's something that students have been focusing a lot. And I think the administration has been really supportive of in general.
So as our close to last question, I guess. What can students do to get involved? What can students do to learn more about Title IX? How can they get involved in this new process that you're talking about, the changes? How can they get involved with OBI? How can they get involved with PRISM?
Yeah, all amazing questions. Wonderful. So with the Title IX Policy Committee, you can always contact Becky Mosley, or you can contact me or the other student members of the committee if you want to talk about the proposals in general, if you want to talk about the process. There's also going to be some open forums happening soon that Becky is leading. There's one on Tuesday, the 12th, from 4 to 5 p.m., location TBD, as well as Thursday, the 14th, from 12:30 to 1:30 p.m., also location TBD, but I think an email will be going out soon with all of that. There's going to be a student forum hosted by me and the other student members of the committee to talk more about the policy and get feedback. OBI is hiring currently. You should definitely apply. An email was sent out to the whole student body through Student Senate that included the application. You can always talk to me more about that. I don't think PRISM is hiring currently, but you can always reach out to SIC. You can reach out if you're in OSCA. You can always run to be a shill for the next semesters. There are a ton of opportunities to get involved. There's also a Student Senate Health and Wellness Working Group. We meet on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. In Wilder TB as well. And that organization has a subgroup that talks a lot about survivor support as well as mental health on campus. And those are obviously intertwined a lot. So if you want to get involved, please contact me or you can email the Oberlin Student Senate email to learn more about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kirsten. You've been listening to The Weekly, a production of WOBC 91.5 FM. The show was created by Daniel Marcus and Johan Kavert. This episode was produced by Roman Brzkowski, me, and
me, Sarah Dalgleish,
and edited by Daniel Marcus. As always, you can find our show on Apple Podcasts and Google Play by searching The Weekly Oberlin, and you can now listen to us on the web at www.anchor.fm/the-weekly. Thank you for listening, and to play us out, some country road.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, blowing like a breeze. Country roads, take me home. Place I belong, West Virginia, Mountain Mama, take me home, country roads.
dark and dusty, painted on the sky. Misty taste of moonshine, teardrop in my eye. Country roads, take me home to the place. Driving down the road, I get a feeling that I should have been home yesterday. Yesterday, country roads, take me home to the place.
the braiding, and in that braid you stay. Look at all the peaches.
Hello, WOBC.
Or hello, Oberlin, I guess.
This is WOBC.
This is WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I am your host, Bridget Conway, back for another hour of One Woman Radio, Monday night, 10 p.m. That's the time and the day. And it is March 4th, in case you didn't know. That last song was The Barrel by